And welcome. Thank you so much for joining us here for our LGBT family planning seminar. And we have some great panelists here today to give you all the information that you need if you're thinking about planning for your family. Hopefully after today's seminar, you'll take away a lot of information, you'll be educated, and maybe you'll feel motivated to grow your family immediately. I'd be super excited if you did that, because then we would be redefining what a nooner actually is. That would be really funny. Anyway, I'm Michelle Miao. I am the host of the Michelle Miao Show, which is broadcasted locally here in San Francisco on Coffee TV on Sunday nights at 9:30, and also nationally on the Progressive Voices Network for radio. So what we're doing today here is we are taping the seminar so that we can broadcast it nationally, both with our broadcast partners, the Commonwealth Club, and also the Michelle Miao Show. So thank you to the Commonwealth Club for hosting and for having us here today. To kick off our program, I'd like to introduce you to Judy Appel. She is the executive director of Our Family Coalition, which is the only LGBTQ family resource organization here in the Bay Area. So, Judy.
Hi, I'm really glad to be involved in this panel with all of you amazing people. And, you know, Our Family Coalition advances equity for LGBTQ, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender-headed families. And we do work with advocacy. We do direct support work with our many families to kind of address the isolation or lack of community that they have, or the lack of our kids seeing their own families reflected in the other families around them. And we do a lot of work in schools, which is some of our most exciting work. And we are getting ready to celebrate our 20th anniversary. And as we've been kind of talking about reflecting over the last 20 years and then looking to where we're going in the future, this opportunity to talk about surrogacy and what is in many ways one of the most current and growing opportunities for families to be able to be created and then create these kids or build these families so that then we can help create an environment and a world in which they can grow grow up and feel safe and seen, and their parents can have the support that they need. I created my family almost 20 years ago. We started talking about having kids. I have a 14-year-old and I have a kid who's almost 18. We're in the whole college application process right now. And I remember when we first started creating our family, we were looking everywhere for some community, some other families, some other parents to talk to. And the options were relatively limited, and the legal protections were, we really had to kind of work around the system to be able to create the legal protections between both of our children and their birth parents. I birthed one child and my partner birthed the other. And for men, the options were even less. Pretty much at that point, men were adopting, which is a great option. But there were very few dads in our community and very few parents. And as time has gone on, we have seen just this deepening of the legal protections that Deborah Wald will talk about for families and for opportunities. And our Family Coalition has been really instrumental in helping to build both the support for the families, to create a world in which our kids can go to school and not be bullied, or where teachers can reflect our community in the classrooms and teach not just acceptance, but inclusion, and that we have been able to help participate in actually really helping to build families. So, for example, one of the things that we have done at our Family Coalition is we've recognized that there are people who want to co-parent. So as the definition of families has expanded, we are noticing that there's more and more people who want to try to co-parent. They want to come up with a way to create families. Where sometimes men and women want to either have two, or either as a couple want to find a donor, or they want to have two couples co-parent together. And our Family Coalition was looking at ways that once we helped provide protections in the law, that now we could help people meet one another. So our Family Coalition started putting together different opportunities for people to explore both the medical side and the financial side, as well as kind of then meet the people that they could possibly create families with. So I was about a year and a half ago, I was actually at an event, and we came up with the idea of having something we now call the egg and sperm mixer, so that guys can meet women who want to have children, and women can meet guys who want to either co-parent or be donors. And we do, it's kind of like a speed dating that we provide. And then from there, then they can move, the guys, once people kind of meet, make connections and they meet one another, and then they kind of meet up later. And we've already had at least one, maybe two babies that have come out of the egg, meat, sperm mixers. And one of the things that I love about this event is that we couldn't do this if we weren't then be able to, we couldn't then know that there's quality medical services for these couples or these families, that there's legal protections to make sure that everybody that goes into the situation knowing what the expectations are and then can realize them. And we've just come a really, really long way in the last 20 years in being able to create those protections for family building. Another really significant change that we've seen has been in the availability of surrogacy for the men, for mostly men, who, but not only men, for the families who, or the parent, the people who want to become parents. And when we first started looking at creating some services for parents who, or for people who wanted to be parents through surrogacy, we pulled together a panel, and I think Deb Wald was there. We pulled together a panel, it was maybe 7 or 8 years ago, and we had a great panel of parents and lawyers, and then we had maybe, I want to say maybe 12 people came to that event. 2 years ago, we started our annual surrogacy conference, and we started with just a several-hour conference because we wanted to see if there was interest, and we were blown away by the interest, and we had over 120 guys show up from all over the Bay Area interested in forming families and really wanting to explore, maybe not surrogacy as the only option, but as an option for creating their family. We had another event last year, a full-day conference, and we had over 160 participants. We're having that event again this year with a group called Men Having Babies that's located out of New York, and we are again anticipating the same number of people of interest. We're having it on January 13th here in San Francisco. And one of the things that's just that kind of humbles me is, you know, we're in this era of post-marriage equality, or in the era of marriage equality nationally, and marriage is really what's really important for a lot of our families. But as marriage has been achieved, and where we're still working out and ironing out exactly what it means for us in a culture and a society, what it does is it allows us to look beyond marriage to what are the things that are really impacting family formation for LGBT people. How are we supporting the transgender parents in our community? How are we able to create safe and welcoming and inclusive environments, not just for those of us who live in a kind of isolated bubble of support, but for all parents across California, throughout the Bay Area, and nationally, that at all families that are have LGBTQ parents are able to live, kind of to normalize the experience of our kids, while of course still recognizing that of course we're different, but that we're different and safe. So I kind of see the surrogacy, the growth of surrogacy, and the growth of our and the excitement in the room at our surrogacy conference as being one of the ways that we are able to help push forward into this next 20 years of where we'll get to a point where our families are a part of the fabric of our community, and our kids can walk into the street and know that they're safe, that Brandon can walk with his kids out in the world and know that he's not going to have to protect them from violence or from negative words, that I can take my kids out Well, if they'll let me, they're teens now. But if I go, if I happen to be out with my teens, that you know they've been raised with the skills to be able to, you know, to kind of stand strong and with pride. And I want the next generation of kids to have those skills, but to maybe not need so much to be on the defensive when they're out there in the world and know that their families are accepted and our families are accepted in the same way that our straight counterparts' families are. So really excited about this. This is a great it's a great show of respect, I think, from the Commonwealth Club to have this this panel and to allow us to talk about this this exciting opportunity that's available for so many. For so many people who want to create their families and explore the journey of parenthood.
Thank you so much, Judy. If you're just tuning in or joining us, that was Judy Appel from Our Family Coalition, which is one of the only LGBTQ resource organizations for LGBTQ families. So today we are having a panel discussion about LGBTQ family planning, but specifically touching on surrogacy. So our next presenter is Dr. Isabel Ryan. She is one of the doctors from Pacific Fertility Center. Pacific Fertility Center has some of the most well-known and well-recognized fertility doctors in the entire world. Yeah, world. Dr. Isabel Ryan.
Thank you, Michelle. So I'm one of the physicians at Pacific Fertility Center, and we are a large fertility center that really services all needs from very low-tech options to very high-tech options. So I was asked to talk about surrogacy, which does involve some higher, what we call higher-tech pieces to creating families. And I'll sort of go through some of the medical considerations. First, I want to just look at terminology. So we, in our clinic and in most clinics in California, use the word gestational carrier for the woman who will be becoming pregnant. And so a gestational carrier is a woman who undergoes an embryo transfer and becomes pregnant without any intention of parenting. So she is doing this without wanting to be a parent. She has no biological link to the child. She does not provide the eggs that created the embryos that were transferred into her uterus. Traditional surrogacy is a woman who becomes pregnant via sperm insemination without intention of parenting, but she does have a biological link to the child because her eggs were used in the embryo that was created. So there's always a risk in that situation of the surrogate deciding that she wants to claim some legal custody over the resulting child. Most IVF centers, and certainly for us, we only engage in contracts where we are using gestational carriers so that at the time that the child is born, that there will be very clear legal protections for the intended parents. So the other word I want to introduce is intended parents, and these are the persons or person who intend to become the parents and will become the parent. And they may or may not have any biological link to the resulting child, but they will become the parent. In choosing a gestational, or who needs a gestational carrier? If we're looking at women who are using gestational carriers, it's women who have an abnormal uterus, either because they were born with abnormalities of the way that their uterus was created, or women who have fibroids or have had prior surgeries to their uterus, or women who have a normal uterus but have had lots of miscarriages, or we've done IVF and transferred a number of embryos, and for whatever reason we suspect that the uterus is not functioning correctly, even though it may have normal shape. Women who lack a uterus, either because the uterus was removed after a hysterectomy, or some women are born without a uterus. Women who may have a medical condition which would preclude them from becoming pregnant. And then obviously men who desire pregnancy, whether single or partnered. In choosing a gestational carrier, there are medical criteria that we recommend. So the gestational carrier should have a proven history of fertility and proven pregnancies to term. That's an important piece, that they have had pregnancies that have gone to term, so healthy pregnancies and pregnancies to term. She should not have any underlying medical problems which would impact her current pregnancy or delivery. We recommend that she be younger than or not older than 40, and that her BMI is below 32. Ideally, probably with current studies, should probably be below 30, but we do accept carriers up to a BMI of 32. They also undergo a psychological evaluation. You really want to have a stable social situation that she will be around during those 9 months that she's gestating your child. There needs to be appropriate motivation. So she wants to, you know, we want her to do it because she enjoys being pregnant and she really wants to provide a gift to somebody else. She would need to undergo testing and procedures during the pregnancy. And so it has to be in line with what the intended parents want. So you have to have a gestational carrier who, if it turns out that there's an abnormality with a resulting fetus, and if the intended parents want to execute a termination, that the gestational carrier would be willing to acknowledge that those are the wishes of the intended parents. This is particularly important if there's more than one embryo that's going to be transferred, if you end up with a multiple gestation, and if there's something wrong with one of the fetuses. We personally encourage single embryo transfers, but there are some clinics who transfer more than one embryo at a time. And it's important that she has completed her family building herself, or is close to the end of her family building, because if something goes wrong during the pregnancy and she ends up with a hysterectomy, you want her to be at relative peace with that event having occurred. It's a rare event, but those are things that need to be brought up ahead of time. We recommend that the gestational carrier be working with an agency. There are many agencies that will recruit gestational carriers. They'll arrange for the initial screening, for the contracts, distribution of scheduled disbursements, arrange for the psychological support that she needs over the 9 months, and also, importantly, as a mediator for yourself and the gestational carrier in case there is some discourse during the course of the pregnancy. Of course, everybody walks into it with good intentions and hoping that everything will go well, but trust me, for those of us who do this often, we've all seen situations where there is a need for support and mediation if there is discourse between all parties. Or they could be working with an established intermediary, such as a law firm, where contracts are established. Again, same other procedures. It's very important, and I'll let Deborah speak to this, it's very important that there is a clear understanding of both the medical and the legal circumstances that are available where your gestational carrier will deliver, because there are legal parameters that have to be taken into account as to where the pregnancy occurred and where the delivery will be happening. And I presented this map here of showing where engaging in a gestational carrier cycle is either legal, illegal, or where there may be restrictions, and this is around the world because patients do seek these services around the world with international tourism. And this is a constantly changing landfield, so things are even different than when I presented this original map. In terms of the medical screening that she will undergo, she will come to us and we will make sure that she grows a nice lining, no pathology. She undergoes blood tests to make sure that she's been immunized for pregnancy required immunizations, and then she undergoes psychological testing. Once we're at the point of creating the embryos, we need to obtain eggs, and these have to obtain via IVF. So you have to undergo IVF to proceed with the gestational carrier cycle. And these eggs can either be one's own eggs, or they can be from an egg donor. Nowadays, there's also the option of obtaining donor eggs from egg banks. We then need a sperm source. This can either be from the intended parent or from a sperm donor. And then we grow the embryos in the laboratory. And now there's the option of selecting embryos, not only by just looking at them and seeing are they growing well or not, which ones appear to be the strongest, but also doing genetic screening on the embryos. And this is to look to make sure that there's the correct number of chromosomes in the embryos. So look for Downs and other abnormalities like that. Part of the reason that we advocate for considering using these techniques is because my understanding is that with most gestational carrier contracts, gestational carriers will be available for usually up to 3 transfers. If you can maximize the chance of success with each transfer, not only are you maximizing the chances of becoming a parent, but also being able to travel that journey with a gestational carrier that you've chosen. This is a picture here showing what embryos look like in the laboratory. The first slide, 2 p.m., is just a fertilized egg. Then on day 2, the embryos will have 4 cells, day 3, 8 cells, day 5, about 200 to 300 cells. And a day 5 embryo is when we can then have the opportunity to proceed with a biopsy, and we'll show you a video, a quick video of how a biopsy is done. So this is a video of a blastocyst, which is a day 5 embryo, and you're seeing the pipette that is pulling out some cells from the embryo itself. These are actually cells that are destined to be the placenta. We take these cells, and then they get sent off to a genetics lab, and the genetics lab will then do chromosome testing to look for Downs and other abnormalities, obviously confirm that we have some embryos that are chromosomally normal, and be able to then just transfer one chromosomally normal embryo at a time to optimize for healthiest pregnancy. Just to give a quick overview of what to expect when we get the results from the genetics lab, if you look at the top column, OD means ovum donor, and the majority of embryos that we will get from the ovum donor will be chromosomally normal embryos. So the average number of embryos that we get to biopsy from an egg donor cycle is 9, and each embryo has a 75% chance of being chromosomally normal. But if the egg source is older, let's say 38 to 40, in that situation we'd have, on average, 4 embryos to biopsy. Each embryo would have a 40% chance of being chromosomally normal, meaning the majority of the embryos at 38 to 40 are going to be chromosomally abnormal. So depending on the age of your egg source, then it will impact overall chances of success and is yet another reason to really consider doing chromosome testing ahead of time. At the time of the embryo transfer, we will assure that the ovaries of the gestational carrier are completely quiescent, no activity, because we need to assure, and this is part of the legal process as well, that the embryo transfer that we did and the pregnancy that resulted from the embryo transfer itself and not from the potential possibility that the gestational carrier got pregnant with her own eggs. So we will assure that her ovaries are quiescent, and then we will grow her lining through a certain hormonal sequence, and then we'll do the embryo transfer itself. So we're going to show you a quick video of what an embryo transfer looks like. So when we have the embryo in the catheter, we will have all the intended parents available in the room, and you can see in the video a little bright spot, which is the tip of the catheter, which is now in the middle of the uterine cavity. And then we deposit the embryo. There's nothing to see when we deposit the embryo because it's microscopic, but then you see that we are pulling back on the little catheter, and now the embryo is in the uterine cavity. It's a very simple and quick process. So in review, when we do a cycle, we need to have egg and sperm of whatever source is desired. We create the embryos in the laboratory, and then we take the embryos and we transfer them into the uterus of the gestational carrier and hopefully achieve a viable pregnancy. Just a quick note on the cost of doing a gestational carrier cycle. So the cost is not just the financial cost, but also the psychological cost in terms of looking for success. And as I mentioned, there is international tourism, medical tourism, in terms of intended parents seeking these services in other countries. And this is a slide here showing the cost. The blue bars are just relative costs, about $120,000 in the US for all services, in India, $30,000, Thailand, $36,000, Ukraine, $39,000. But it's very important to really look at the success rate. So on this graph is also a red bar that goes downwards. So highest success typically is in the US. You have to be careful in terms of your expectations for success if you travel abroad. And then, as I'm sure Deborah will speak, or maybe some of the other speakers will speak, about, along with that assurance that really the child that you want to take home is created with the gametes of your original intention. So there are lots of issues really and considerations in terms of international gestational carrier services.
Thank you, Dr. Isabel Ryan. If you're just joining us or just tuning in, I'm Michelle Miao, host of The Michelle Miao Show, an LGBTQ-inclusive radio and local TV talk program. Today, we are excited to be here at the Commonwealth Club of California, and who is hosting us for a special LGBTQ panel discussion on surrogacy. And so Dr. Ryan had just gone through the medical side of surrogacy. Our next presenter is Brandon Miller, who is with the Brio Financial Group. And the financial group, of course, has been working with plenty of families, but specifically LGBTQ families. And so one of the things, if you are thinking about surrogacy, something that's top of mind is cost. And I'm sure Brandon will give us the solution in how we're going to pile up enough cash to grow our families. Brandon Miller.
Not quite sure about that solution. Personal story, first of all, is we did use a gestational carrier. I'm in a co-parenting situation. I have two twins, 2.5-year-old boys, who I'm proud to say are now potty trained. So we are well on our way. From a financial planning perspective, definitely we get this question a fair bit in my office with clients. The reality is the surrogacy issue versus having a children issue to begin with. The surrogacy issue complicates it a little bit, but it's actually a relatively simple question to answer. So you can, for better or worse, I liken it to a remodeling project. You have a decent idea of what those costs are. There is variability amongst clinics and how you go about surrogacy, but it's a relatively well-defined cost to go through the surrogacy process. To me, the question is also relatively simple as to whether or not you actually have the funds available to pay for that. So in my world, I like to think that those funds are actually in your account prior to you having children. And no, I don't count retirement accounts or equity in real estate or those things. More often than not, it is not necessarily the question of the surrogacy. It is that whether or not one can afford surrogacy, it's whether they can afford to have children to begin with. And that is obviously a much more difficult question to answer. I almost always say the answer to that is yes, because where there is a will, there's a way. So I think you can always have children. My feels to me like people have kids with a whole lot less money than what most of us in this room have, and somehow they always manage to figure it out. So yes, the financial aspects have to be included, and it's something to take into account, and at the same time, I think we can always figure it out. Surrogacy, of course, is just one option to have kids, and there are plenty of other options that sometimes we need to look at those other options. When someone does decide to have children, we look at, first of all, just is there enough money available? But also I immediately start thinking about things such as what the budget looks like. So budget is often a dirty word in my office, but we have to do it for almost everyone, regardless of how much money is made or how much money people have. I always need to know how much there is to begin with. So we literally just take how much is coming in and how much is going out, and then we try and do that assuming that there is a child there. So what will change? And there usually are a fair number of changes. Biggest ones are if someone is going to stop working, so if the incomes are different. And then also, so someone oftentimes will take time off work to help care for the kid. And if not, then how are we going to help pay for the child care itself? So sometimes we're lucky enough to have family around. Sometimes a parent is taking time off work. Sometimes it's budgeting for daycare or nannies. Here in San Francisco, the cost can be pretty high on that. So I usually allow, if someone is hiring it out, a good $1,000 to $2,000 a month for care is usually in the right range. The other big topic that has to come up initially is housing. So especially here in San Francisco, there literally is there enough space to house the kids? And where are we going to live? So plenty of clients will end up moving out of the San Francisco proper, one, just to get enough space to have kids. And that to me is very much value. So a whole lot of what gets discussed in the office is around values and how people are going to choose to spend their money. So certainly there's always enough money to go around, but oftentimes we do need to reprioritize our lives and figure out where those dollars are going. So housing is one of the most obvious examples. So in many cases, if someone can move out a little bit to get a little more space in a backyard, they also might get a good school district. And so oftentimes we'll talk about trading off property taxes for school, private school, and how that balances out. Other big costs that tend to come into play are the protection pieces, if you will. So thinking about just purely protecting the kids. So insurances, immediately I think about life insurance that comes to mind and disability insurance that we worry about. There's also the, in talking about protection, literally just the legal protections that come into play. So working with a state and family law attorney in order to get the legal protections in place. One, during surrogacy, obviously there's lots of legal contracts there, but even more so, as with any child, making sure that those basic documents are there for guardianship of minors. Then, of course, I start thinking about education funding. So both on the as elementary or whatever we're doing while the kids are young, but college funding. College funding can be incredibly expensive, as we all know. some people in the room are looking at that next year. The good news is there's plenty of money available, generally speaking, to help kids with college education. So while we do our best to save for those, there are also other ways to get money to help kids go through school. And honestly, I actually think it's a really good thing to have kids take out student loans anyhow. It helps them be a little more responsible and appreciate the education. So ultimately, a lot of what I think about when, you know, if someone is, whether or not they can have kids is really much more just about children in general as opposed to surrogacy in particular. And ultimately, it's just a matter of choosing one's priorities. So the dollar shift where I went prior to having kids versus where I go today are two very different things, and somehow the dollars seem to balance themselves out. So I do not... while it is important that we always work from a budget and get those numbers down, I also think it's always very doable. And that's what I think about for financial.
Perfect. Thank you, Brandon. Brandon Miller is with Brio Financial Group. Thanks again for joining us today. Today we have a panelist of experts who are touching on surrogacy and LGBTQ family planning. So earlier we heard from Judy Appel of Our Family Coalition, which is one of the only resource groups for LGBTQ families. We learned a little bit about the medical side of surrogacy with Dr. Isabel Ryan of Pacific Fertility Center, and we just heard from Brandon Miller of Brio Financial Group. Our last but not least presenter, and which is probably a good chunk of before we even start the process of planning our family, is always answering, is this legal? And that has a lot to do with the fact that LGBT families have not really been outside in mainstream media in making, families. And if you live in different states, the laws change, and as Dr. Isabel Ryan had just mentioned, people are seeking resources outside of the country, in which if you don't know anything about Ukraine or Thailand, the laws change there too. So we're very, very happy and excited to have Deborah Wald here today to answer some of the legal questions you might have when it comes to surrogacy. Deborah Wald.
Thank you so much. So first, my disclaimer, I am only licensed to practice law in the state of California, although I'm part of multiple national organizations and do have some familiarity with the law around the country and around the world. My area of practice is here in California, and I've been handling surrogacy cases for probably 15 years. I've done many of them, and many of them in the LGBT community, although also I do many of them for straight couples. And for singles, actually. I'm seeing more and more singles pursuing parenthood through surrogacy. California is considered a surrogacy-friendly state, and that makes us a destination for individuals and couples from around the country and around the world who are looking to have children through surrogacy. I currently have gay and lesbian couples in my practice from at least three or four different countries where gay men and lesbians are not provided fertility services actually at all to assist them in having children. And so many of them end up coming to California, other states as well, but a lot come to California. I've had clients from Australia, I've had clients from Germany, I've had clients from Spain, and France, a number of other countries that are behind us, if you will, in their evolution around thinking about supporting LGBT families with children. So figuring out what the law is always part of the equation. When we're creating children through surrogacy in California, California law will govern that initial process. But it's very, very important for people to be mindful of where they're going to be raising their children. I personally consider it irresponsible and maybe malpractice to assist a couple in creating a child without making sure they're going to be able to take that child home and raise that child in a safe way with everything that child needs in that child's life, access to healthcare, access to education that go with that child being recognized as a citizen of the child of the country the child is growing up in. If it's a couple, we need to make sure that where they're taking that child home to will recognize both of the members of the couple as parents. I actually just today heard that there's been an 8-year battle going on between a gay male couple from Texas who came to California to have children together, and they conceived twins through surrogacy. The law was all done here in California. They went home to Texas with beautiful, healthy twins and a judgment from the California court that said they were both parents. And they subsequently broke up in Texas, and the biological father, with the assistance of the Alliance Defense Fund, who are tasked and do their fundraising around attacking our families, among other things, the biological father has been fighting for 8 years to try and get Texas to dishonor California's parentage judgment. And I just heard this morning that the Texas Supreme Court finally has dismissed the petition for review after having requested full briefing on the issues, and that case finally seems to be dead. And those children do have two legal parents in Texas. Texas is honoring California's judgment. But none of us want, when we're trying to help a couple or an individual have children, to give them children and an 8-year lawsuit. That's not the point of the exercise. So being careful about the law is critically important. And making sure, I won't engage in international surrogacy unless I have a counterpart in the child's home country that I'm in communication with who can reassure me that that child will have a safe landing when they get home legally. So that's really important for LGBT families. And just to briefly touch on what Isabel was talking about, you know, the flip side is, to do it right, and we do give, in California, we have a very good roadmap at this point for how to do it right. We've provided a lot of protections to LGBT families, and we've provided a lot of protections to any families using assisted reproduction to have children. And frankly, I think it's constantly evolving. Every year we improve our laws, but they're moving very much in the right direction, and we do have really rigorous protections for singles, for gay couples, for straight couples, for transgender-headed families who are having children in California. So that's something to feel good about. But doing it right can be really, really expensive. You know, to hire me and Brandon and Isabel, we can all make sure that your family's extremely well protected, but there's obviously a pretty hefty price tag on that. And so what I'm seeing is also a lot of families who are either coming to events like this or coming through my office trying to figure out how to do this less expensively. And one of the things that people do come up with is the idea of going to Mexico, going to Thailand, going to India, where the medical process is significantly less expensive. I was at a conference a few years ago, a surrogacy conference, where we had an ethicist come speak to us about both the medical and legal ethics of assisted reproduction law. And it's always stayed with me that she said, there really are two types of attorneys. They're the pilots and they're the janitors. The pilot's job is to help you get to your destination safely. And the janitor's job is to clean up messes. And unlike in the real world, in the legal world, the pilots actually get paid a lot less than the janitors. And I'm one of the few attorneys who does both. And I can tell you that when someone comes to me to consult with me about how to get safely to their destination, one of the things I have to tell them, if they're trying to cut costs in doing that, they're way more likely to need my janitorial services. And I'm not saying that to be unrealistic or patronizing or disrespectful of how expensive this can be. But I have been involved now with two separate couples, one gay, one straight, who went to India to have children. The U.S. Department of State, 100% of the time, will require DNA testing before they will grant citizenship to a child born to U.S. citizens through assisted reproduction abroad, or any kind of reproduction abroad. And I have been involved in two cases where the DNA testing showed no match, to everyone's shock, either because the wrong embryos were implanted or because the surrogate actually ended up getting pregnant with her own eggs. We don't know. But one of those couples was stranded in India for 6 months, the other for 8 months. Both of them were finally able to get their children back to the United States through a grant of humanitarian parole. The U.S. Senate was involved in one of the cases, and we still have not actually, the older of those two children is about to turn two. He still isn't a citizen. We still haven't fully regularized his status. His parents still aren't able to travel with him because of that. And, you know, the nightmare goes on. It would have been less expensive for them to pay me and Brandon and Isabel than what it has cost them to try to clean up that mess. So I really want to caution people, and particularly India is an example. India is a country that banned gay couples doing surrogacy when there were many gay couples who had surrogates pregnant in India, and it created a nightmare. They did ultimately release those babies to the families that were in progress. But it's really worth taking time and putting a lot of thought into taking things abroad, because when you take things abroad, you have to look at both what is the law about surrogacy where you're going, and is there support for LGBT families where you're going? And from my perspective, unless the answer is yes on both of those points, and also you are comfortable that the clinic is highly reputable and able, it's probably not worth the money you're saving because of the risks. Here in California, as Isabel mentioned, and around the country, there are two different kinds of surrogacy. And so what I'm more frequently seeing for folks trying to save money is trying to go with traditional surrogacy instead of gestational surrogacy. Isabel defined the term, so I won't again. A gestational surrogate is carrying a baby not biologically related to her, genetically related to her, and a traditional surrogate is the biological mother of the child she's carrying. California has very, very clear laws and very, very clear procedures in place for doing gestational surrogacy right. We don't care if they're donated eggs or donated sperm or both. We're not a genetics-based system. There are other states that have taken a more genetics-based approach. In California, when it comes to gestational surrogacy and most assisted reproduction, we're all about documented intentions. So as long as you have a clear contract in writing between the parties documenting who the intended parents are and who's providing sperm or eggs or a womb without an intention to parent, the courts generally are enforcing those agreements. With traditional surrogacy, in our family code, we actually have a definition of traditional surrogacy, just what it means, what the term means, and that's the only time it's mentioned in our entire family code. Basically, our legislature gave us a definition and then no guidelines. So we don't know how to do traditional surrogacy right. And for that reason, I've been involved in a couple of traditional surrogacy cases a year. But when I'm advising my clients, I advise them that if they're going to use a traditional surrogate, it better be someone to whom they would give their healthcare proxy. That is to say, they would entrust to that person life and death decision making for them. Because if you're trusting them to have a baby for you without clear legal protections in place that will make them give you that baby, you're basically putting your life in their hands. So that's how seriously I take it. And with that said, it is a much, much, potentially a much healthier process as well as a less expensive process because you don't have all the medical procedures and medications and, you know, hormones and all that stuff involved. It just involves a woman getting pregnant. And it's way less expensive. So it is appealing for many people, but you really are taking your life in your hands from a legal perspective when you do that. So I think that's all I have time for today. I appreciate everyone tuning in, and be thoughtful and then enjoy your families.
I want to take this time to thank our panelists, Judy Appel of Our Family Coalition, Dr. Isabel Ryan of Pacific Fertility Center, Brandon Miller of Brio Financial Group, and Deborah Wald of Wald Law Group. Just want to make that clear for anyone tuning in. If you'd like to ask questions or contact them directly, we'll also post that information up online. At this time, we have a few minutes for those on the floor. If you have any questions for our panelists, I also have a bank of questions that we got beforehand to fill our time here for an hour, and to remind folks, we are taping this for broadcast both on television and radio. So we have one question here. State your name and your question, please.
Thank you, Jim Rosen. Marriage didn't come up very much, especially about protection. Can you comment about that, specifically Brandon and Deborah?
Okay, so marriage equality. Congratulations, everyone. Happy day. And marriage does not necessarily provide any protection when it comes to being parents. It doesn't necessarily not provide protection either. It really is state by state. So every state has something we call a marital presumption, which means that when a married woman gives birth, her spouse is presumed to be the second parent of that child. I just stated it in a gender-neutral way, but it's not gender-neutral in every state, and this is a battle we're now fighting state by state, particularly in the states that were reluctant about embracing marriage equality, but not exclusively. For example, New York. A New York court recently found that a lesbian who gave birth, her spouse is not the second parent of that child because they take a more genetics-based approach and have been very skeptical about surrogacy. And there are a number of states, Arizona is another one, where a husband, if it turns out he's not actually the biological father, the marital presumption goes away. So it's very much what impact marriage will have on our safety as LGBT parents is going to vary very, very much state by state. And frankly, I think it is going to be the battleground for some time. Employment rights is the other one, because we've heard now of multiple cases where people took a little time off from work to get married and came back to no job because they were fired for being gay once they got married. So I think those are really the two areas, but equality around parenting issues really is separate, and it's a big battleground going forward. I see Judy wants to say something.
I'll chime in quickly. Certainly from a financial perspective, marriage matters a ton, whether it be taxes or Social Security implications. There's all kinds of things that, you know, would get impacted, whether or not someone was married versus domestic partnered. And so that's certainly something that we look at in trying to figure out what, you know, how covered everyone is.
I just wanted to add something that Deborah said, which is that that we are seeing in many states. It's kind of ironic because children and the battle around the right to have families and the protections for our kids were at the center of the marriage equality cases. And yet we're seeing that in many places this is again going to be the battleground for full equality. And it's one of the reasons why, I mean, here in California, we had many of the rights and protections, both protections and the responsibilities of marriage under domestic partnership before we actually had marriage equality. But we're still fighting for or continuing to push for kind of the visibility and recognition in society that I believe will ultimately lead to a shift in the states where there's still resistance to recognizing the legal protections for our families. Because there's still a lot of fear and bias against people, LGBTQ people with kids. And I think in order to change the laws, we're going to really have to shift that perception. So I agree, kind of first comes love, then comes marriage, and now baby in the baby carriage. And before, okay, because I wanted to mention something then afterwards, maybe Michelle, about the economic piece. So why don't I pass it back to you, Deborah, and then.
I can't believe I left this out. This is the soapbox I've been on. So here's the fix. Lesbians and gay men, married or unmarried, regardless of what presumptions may exist and what any birth certificate says, need to go to court and get a judgment that says they're both parents. It is the only way to protect our children. Everyone should still be going and getting a judgment. In California, we've made it really easy to do that, which also makes it quite inexpensive to do that, but it's a step that can't be bypassed. That couple in Texas I was talking about, the only reason that that child has two parents is because they had a court judgment that's entitled to full faith and credit. So if you don't have a court judgment, where you're standing when the question is asked is going to determine the answer. And I don't know anyone who can stand that level of uncertainty when it comes to their relationships with their children. So please, 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 no matter how protected you feel by the state you're living in, get your judgments.
Deborah has been saying that since I've known her, probably about 15 years, and I think we'll reach. It will be a victory when she feels safe enough to not say that. They feel like we are safe enough to not say that. So I just wanted to mention that the question about. I loved that you said, Brandon, that everybody can figure it out, because that's a very optimistic message about having kids, because ultimately it's the greatest journey and we want to help make it possible for people. And I wanted to put a pitch in for Men Having Babies. They have a website, menhavingbabies.org, and they're one of, I think, the only place that I'm aware of that's offering financial assistance for people to be able to have, to engage in surrogacy. Part of the proceeds from our conference go to that, the local scholarships, but they have scholarships for people or financial assistance for people throughout the state. So I just wanted to put a pitch in to go there if you're interested in using surrogacy. They also rate different agencies, whether both the fertility centers as well as attorneys and other intermediaries. Like I think somebody said, you were saying that there's a lot of different ways to go about engaging in surrogacy. You can do a one-stop shop, or you can use different people, and there's different agencies to provide different support. And all those things have financial implications. And so I just think when you're working with Brandon, that's one of the things that you can figure out is the different ways, what landscape's gonna work best for you.
Almost was afraid that we may have more time to fill, but it looks like we have time for another question before we need to end, so I want to make sure that I grab someone from the floor. And your name and question, please.
Okay, thank you. Hi, my name is Elliot Hossman. I wanted to talk to Dr. Ryan about some of the genetic screening that you were talking about. I think particularly as we're in this moment where we're recognizing that LGBT families have faced a history of discrimination, the same could probably be said, right, for people facing disabilities and neuroatypicalities. So can you walk me through some of the counseling and procedure when parents are faced with the decision of whether or not to have a chromosomally atypical child?
Sure. So The world of genetics and our understanding of genetics and our ability to do chromosome testing along with other testing on embryos is growing incredibly. Things have changed really completely, even in the past 3 years, I'm going to say. So the chromosome testing that we currently do is looking to make sure that there is the correct number of chromosomes in the embryo. And that is to rule out for issues where there are either missing or extra chromosomes, which will lead to either embryos that do not implant. So if we were to transfer that embryo, it leads to a negative pregnancy test result for the gestational carrier. Or we transfer it and it would lead to a miscarriage. Now, there are some chromosomal abnormalities that lead to live births. And so 3 of chromosome 21, which is Down syndrome, is one of those where they do get past these biological checkpoints of either not implanting or miscarrying on their own and can lead to a live birth. So those are the things right now that we screen for. Along with that are the sex chromosomes, obviously. So in terms of choice, sometimes some patients will say, I want to know what the sex of the embryo will be. There are some patients who choose not to know. For those who want to know, they would have an ability to choose if they want to transfer a female or a male embryo. I'm not going to be surprised if another 3 years from now there are yet a whole bunch of other things that we may be able to test for. This is a huge area of ethical controversy or conversation, I'll say, and maybe controversy. And each IVF center really kind of has to come with their own comfort level in terms of what they will or will not do, what they are willing to test for or not test for. Currently, our IVF center does not transfer embryos that have been identified as having a chromosomal abnormality. So, for example, if we have an embryo that is trisomy 21, we know it's a Down's embryo, our current policy is that we will not transfer those embryos. So anything that's identified as abnormal will not be transferred. Most IVF centers operate under that guideline as well. Because the question then becomes, well, if you would transfer the embryo anyway, why do the testing? You should just go ahead and transfer without the testing. On our part, we sort of have our own sort of medical ethical guidelines, which is first do no harm. And so we have to sort of work with our own personal sense of ethics in terms of what we are willing to transfer or not transfer. Because one of the unspoken voices in the room is always the voice of the child. So as we are creating these embryos, we have to think about the future child that we are helping create, which is not there yet. And there are lots and lots of ethics about, how does one approach that?
All right, that concludes our program. I'd love to take a moment here and a round of applause for our panelists, Judy Appel, Dr. Isabel Ryan, Brandon Miller, and Deborah Wald. And for more information and all other podcasts, we do interviews that are much more in-depth. You can head to commonwealthclub.org. And if you'd like some LGBT-inclusive interviews, you can search Meow. John Zipper of Commonwealth Club and I co-host every Tuesday on the Michelle Meow Show, and we talk about LGBTQ issues. And for everything else, I guess you can head to michellemeow.com, where you can also find the alphabet soup that we produce with our family coalition. Thank you again for tuning in, and thanks for those who joined us.